Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and this is our 82nd episode of Revolution Z. This time our topic is writing in these very troubled times. So, let's begin. People are scummy, mired in greed, habituated to lying, prone to violence. No, people are enlightened, socially moved, honest, magnanimous, supportive. Both extremes clearly exist, but in fact people are multifaceted creatures. In some settings we become saintly and good. In other settings, we become greedy and despicable. In case you doubt the extremes, look around. Small and large acts of community-serving kindness, solidarity, and courage are bursting forth all over every map. People daily brave dangers out of solidarity for folks they don't know and seek nothing from. Kindness begets kindness. Goodness is on parade. Simultaneously, however, small and large acts of demonic cruelness and self-serving antisociality are bursting forth all around. We receive, daily, hourly, perpetual, unceasing accounts of awfulness. News endlessly records and highlights multitudinous evils. Reports redundantly mount up until their perpetual enumeration itself fuels more despair and anger. Evil begets evil. Evil is on parade. Assembling to the right, a pugnacious array proclaims itself tough, steely, and even heroic. Assembling to the left, an amorous array proclaims itself honest, committed, and even historic. The pugnacious array aims to follow Trump back past last year's well-suffered normal to even more authoritarian, fascistic horrors. The amorous array wants to transcend Trump to attain social democracy or even a revolutionized new world. But who marches in the opposed arrays? Very roughly, the Republican Party, the old-line Democratic Party and its supporters, Donald Trump's more grassroots supporters, the newly dissident Democratic Party and its supporters, unaligned non-voters, the Green Party, DSA, and Bernie Sanders supporters, the rest of the socialist and anarchist left as well, and the many progressive and radical social movements and organizations that don't define themselves ideologically or electorally. And finally, many, many millions horrified at the knee-to-the-neck murder that has labeled police violence what it is, unfathomably foul racist lynching. What possible steps do each of these groups favor? How might left writers foster the humane favored steps and hinder the more suicidal ones? The Republican Party follows and elevates Trump. It sings hooray for our side. It risks massive dislocation and death. It follows Trump's ever-fluctuating whims to hell and back. Some Republicans are shaken out of comatose, corporate, semi-religious habits by the horrors they now see unfolding. They dissent a bit, but none, I suspect, dissent due to entreaties by leftists. The Republican mainstream hasn't read, doesn't read, and won't read left entreaties. There is therefore little point in leftists writing for them. Regarding the Republican Party, we can usefully only build activist movements large enough to force them to alter their choices. At least for now, no convincing. Only compelling. Next up, the old-line Democratic Party elite will vigorously back Biden, but will barely if ever attempt to redirect post-election agendas away from old normal business as usual. I doubt many old-liners will defect toward more progressive, much less seriously radical agendas. I therefore see barely more reason for leftists to direct their writing to old-line Democratic Party elites than to Republicans. The Democratic Party's mainstream elites do not read the left. Their leadership has made abundantly clear that they would rather lose a presidential election than accommodate even highly popular demands that would threaten their hold on their party. After the election, as at all times, they too should face movements large enough to sufficiently threaten their interests that they decide to alter their choices. Very little convincing, overwhelmingly compelling. What about Trump's more grassroots supporters? At the top, their exalted, elevated, self-enthroned leader seems only to seek gains for himself and his peers. He cares only to preserve and enlarge the gilded perch that he and his peers occupy. He showers his limitless hate even on his allies at the slightest sign that firing them can bring him personal gain. However, at antagonism's rank-and-file levels, particularly in opioid-ravaged and economically impoverished rural counties, motives appear more than a bit murky, or perhaps more accurately, more than a bit conflicted. One large subset of Trump's supporters sees itself imminently drowning under high water rising. It wants to preserve the collapsing but not yet totally collapsed, rusted, low-level ledge it clings to. and who wouldn't cling tight above the horror they quite accurately fear awaits them below? Lack of information about their severely curtailed options, more than advanced malevolence, drives this survivalist subset to suicidally support wrong leaders. Indeed, if information and options were to realign their focus a bit, their alienation, pain, and anger might come to serve positive aims. But for now, desperate Trump supporters won't relish attacks on Trump or on their own past or current allegiances. They aren't going to love elite Democrats, and rightly so. Calling them names and otherwise disparaging them or people they relate to is not going to win their attention. But desperate Trump supporters might closely assess graphic, sympathetic, and militant acknowledgments of their grim predicament, particularly given how COVID-19 has made ever more evident the ills of the existing systems they endure. They might be moved by clear presentations of steps to escape their predicament, and only then they might hear clear indications of why Trump is an obstacle to their survival, much less their well-being. Reaching this constituency therefore seems a promising and important task for left writers. Convincing, not compelling. A significantly smaller subset of the grassroots part of the antagonistic array has had their generous, caring sides seriously trumped. They rejoice, it seems, in the momentary mob high they get from self-righteously hating immigrants, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Muslims, LGBTQ, workers, and women, plus hating anyone challenging their side, their gang, their mob, or especially challenging their entertainer, tormentor, in chief. Very few left writers can write meaningfully to this group, but for those few who can, reaching out to opponents has got to be at least as strategic as telling allies what they already agree with. In sum, the aims of the antagonistic array can turn more quickly than a hummingbird whenever the head man himself tweets a new tune, or perhaps whenever new information and options become known. Bar the borders, load the guns, make America great again, open the economy, take hydroxychloroquine, drink bleach, dominate protesters, send in the army. When I try to enumerate the right's actual aims, I have to admit I am not sure what they seek, other than to serve their master against whatever enemies his curdling mind conjures. Which, of course, suggests, again, that left writers equipped to do so ought to present positive aims directly to these sectors, in ways that might actually reach them. Next, unaligned non-voters are huge in number, and polls tell us they have elements like all the above. But polls also tell us that they are too alienated and exhausted trying to survive, or too uninspired by candidates and prospects to pay attention to politics. So the same calculation for a writer follows. If one has a place to write that non-voters, including a disproportionate number of young people, tend to read, and if one can non-rhetorically and sympathetically address their concerns, showing systemic causes and activist possibilities, that too is well worth doing. But now what about the amorous angelic array? Where is it headed? And what can we left writers who publish in periodicals and on sites which that array regularly frequents usefully provide them? Consider first the newly dissident Democratic Party, extending from less known but more radical local officials through AOC to Senator Warren. They know there are massive life-extinguishing problems. They mostly know the institutional sources of those ubiquitous ills. To forestall calamities, they will rightly oppose Trump winning again. They will rightly support Biden in swing states. The immediate issue for this group is, will they do that in a way that enlarges their beachhead inside the party and that prepares groundwork for fighting not just electorally, but also at the grassroots? Or will they do it in ways that tend to melt them back into the party's mainstream? Put differently, will Democratic Party dissidents accept that Biden is merely a far lesser evil, but an evil nonetheless? So that the task is not only to elect him so as to remove Trump, but to push him as hard as possible from the grassroots? Or will they get so caught up in supporting Biden that they start seeing him as objectively positive? And what can left-writers do to help foster the better result? Most of us can't do research for dissident Democrats, though maybe some of us can get important analyses into the hands of other movement activists who regularly engage with the electeds and their staffs. Maybe we can think outside the box of typical dead-end policy advocacy to recommend paths better aimed at seeking further gains. Maybe we could even bolster their confidence that dissidence is a far better stance than trying to join the mainstream. What will only antagonize them, however, is to tell them that beating Trump is a waste of time because he isn't that much worse. Such messages will rightly undercut left credibility with Democratic Party dissidents, thereby undermining messages we might usefully provide. All in all, however, I doubt this group should be a major focus of the informed left's writing. Maybe after the election that will change. But until then, it isn't clear how much Democratic Party dissidents will even have time to hear, much less to act on leftist messages while doing nonstop electioneering. Who's next? The Green Party, DSA, Bernie Sanders supporters, and the rest of the socialist, anarchist, feminist, and now increasingly massively anti-racist and grassroots social movement left are each very far from homogenous, of course. But here, I think, is a natural and one hopes very interested and quite huge audience for left writers. This constituency well knows what is wrong with society. They well know activism is essential. They read what left writers publish. But to offer the merely hooray for our side wouldn't add needed insights. So what would be most timely, relevant, and not redundant for these audiences? On the one hand, how to relate to the coming election is intensely controversial and unresolved. So continuing that debate, not full of vituperation and denigration, but full of close attention and respectful thought, may be particularly valuable. Whether Trump wins again is the paramount issue of the next 6 months, bearing on the next 10 years and longer. So making clear that one can vote and indeed encourage others to vote for Biden to beat Trump in swing states without its meaning anything more than that we care hugely about the immense evilness gap between Trump further empowered and Biden somewhat beholden to an ever more progressive electorate is a worthy task left writers can usefully address. But beyond any election, what post-coronavirus, post-capitalism, post-racism, and post-sexism institutions we desire, as well as strategic insights about how to win those institutions, is also controversial and unresolved. For a left audience which reads the left media that left writers mostly publish in, perhaps addressing these matters should be a high priority. For that same audience, perhaps exposing Trump's daily lies and proclaiming the evils of evil is mostly pushing an open door. Such writing is relatively easy, garners applause, and won't be questioned, whereas taking up controversial issues that matter to what progressive and radical audiences do is harder and often ignored or even ridiculed. Nonetheless, don't we need more of the latter? Finally, what does our little survey suggest about priorities for leftist writers who want to go through social democracy and on to another world? When writing, keep our audience as well as left prospects in mind. That's obvious, right? Maybe so, but then how does one explain that a great many left periodicals receive article after article that tell already well-informed people that Trump is the devil without a disguise, that war kills, that capitalism impoverishes and alienates, that racism subjugates and distorts, that sexism shatters and humiliates, that markets relegate and pollute, and that, well, pain hurts. They receive article after article that does all that, but they receive comparatively few that offer vision and strategy. Does the imbalance inadvertently make it appear as if endless horror is rock solid and forever? Will left readers of left outlets strategize better due to such communications? So what's an insightful, energetic, well-informed leftist writer to do? If we have access to the dissident sectors of the Democratic Party, if we can offer them support and some useful policy suggestions without dismissing their support for Biden, we should. If we somehow have access to disaffected or alienated Trump voters or to abstainers, presumably via mainstream media, and if we can communicate in a way that doesn't disparage them, but instead seeks to side with them about their plight, though of course not about all their practices, we should. If, on the other hand, we write for left outlets, mostly articles that rehash that Trump is vile, or that the system is vile, and even offering utterly brilliant formulations of the same, but not presenting alternatives, and not discussing modes and methods of seeking alternatives, then no matter how well we do it, perhaps we should entertain the possibility that those efforts will rarely alter any of our readers' thinking on such matters, precisely because they already agree. On the other hand, if we offer, however tentatively, vision for a better future, strategy and program for seeking it, and lessons from positive efforts at change, whether in addition to our commentaries on Trump and on our current oppressions, or even just unto itself, perhaps that will provide useful insights that are now in undersupply, and so perhaps we should give those pursuits more attention. Following on all the above, I wonder as I write, are there some rough, flexible guidelines I and writers and publishers like me ought to follow? Here are some that seem sensible to me, and that I feel like I ought to abide. Hopefully, other publishers, writers, and readers will refine them or propose better guides. To judge ourselves so we do better seems like as important as anything else we might now be doing. 1. The merit of an article can certainly be enhanced by greater audience size and appreciation. But the final measure of merit is not applause or likes, but what an article facilitates and provokes for winning change now and for winning a better society and world in the future. 2. In that light, offering what isn't already widely available has great potential to facilitate and provoke what would otherwise go undiscussed. Addressing what is under-addressed should therefore be a high priority. On the other hand, writing what is already widely written has a lot less potential. 3. Writing that presents positive aims and means for change has great potential to facilitate and provoke, and should therefore be a high priority. On the other hand, writing that reports pain and suffering, while important, has less prospect to facilitate and provoke, so perhaps ought to be a lower priority. 4. Finally, writing clearly is certainly better than writing obscurely. Articles should therefore be as complex and as long as facilitating and provoking efforts at worthy change requires, but they should be no more complex and no longer than that. These 4 points are obvious. There's really nothing subtle about them. But the problem is we writers don't always pay attention to them. We often write more or less spontaneously what we're thinking about or what we feel important to ourselves, but not strategically, not trying to figure out how our writing might impact other people, how our writing might fill a niche that's needed, how our writing might address needs, how our writing might help build movement. And that's what I think this episode is trying to address, and I hope that maybe it has provided something useful. All that said, and equally applicable not just to writing, but speaking, filming, podcasting, and communicating in general, we come to a delicate request of a sort I intensely hate making. Revolution Z needs your help. Please, if Revolution Z's focus on vision and strategy resonates with your feelings about what activism needs in coming months and years, take a few minutes to visit www.patreon.com/revolutionz. There you can become a patron and provide support at any level that suits you. We certainly need anything you can manage. By the same token, we also need help in getting Revolution Z to be known, to be heard, to have an impact, to be able to have an effect. And that depends on people talking about it. Maybe you do it on social media. Maybe you do it with friends directly. Maybe you do it in some comments that you post. Any way that you might do it, any way that you might make Revolution Z a bit more visible to a bit more people would be fantastically helpful. And I thank you in advance. This is Michael Albert, signing off for now for Revolution Z.